Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, contributing editor and film critic for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is T.R. Witcher, associate editor of Las Vegas Weekly and certified Bondologist, I think is what we called you in the paper.
Thank you. I like the sound of that. Good to be here.
So the big thing and pretty much the only thing going on this week is Quantum of Solace, the new James Bond movie.
Right.
And I know you are a James Bond aficionado.
Yes, yes, to put it mildly.
So this is the...
Certifiable.
Right, exactly. But in a good way, in a good way. This is the second James Bond film to feature Daniel Craig as James Bond,
right,
after Casino Royale, which came out a couple years ago. And for me, as a sort of non-Bond aficionado, I wouldn't say that I am... against Bond or whatever. I don't dislike Bond, but I haven't seen a whole lot of Bond movies. I'm sort of indifferent to the whole idea. But I enjoyed this new film, I think even more than I expected to. Because Casino Royale had a lot of hype behind it. Mm-hmm. And coming into that, I had only seen like one other Bond movie at the time. And I think I was expecting something really cool and exciting. And I felt like Casino Royale was a little bloated, a little unfocused. You know, I really enjoyed it at first and then it kind of petered out a little. Mm-hmm. But this one sort of never let up, you know, which I know was one of your criticisms of it in the review that you did,
yeah,
in the paper. But I liked that about it, that it was just like sort of nonstop action, very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the story still held well together, even though it moved through it quickly. I liked the villain, and I like the whole idea of Bond's sort of quest for revenge,
mm-hmm,
for the people who killed his girlfriend from the first movie,
right,
and how it was sort of impossible to achieve,
mm-hmm,
which was, you know, sort of a melancholy theme for a James Bond movie.
Yeah, I mean, a very, bleak may be a little bit strong, but a fairly grim movie, and certainly I'm in the camp of fans who, I mean, as I say in the review, they're those who sort of like the lighthearted Bond. You know, one of the comments you'll often see is folks who say the whole point is like the cheese factor, is the, you know, kind of cats being stroked and just ridiculous, kind of over the top, and you're not,
right,
you're not meant or encouraged to take any of it, you know, seriously. On any level of seriousness, not even on sort of just like big budget action movie seriousness,
right, right,
let alone sort of, you know, more serious film seriousness. But then there are those of us, I'm in kind of the second camp, who like, you know, a more straightforward, a more believable, credible character.
Right.
And so, you know, Daniel Craig is certainly given that to us in these two movies. So,
yeah.
It's exciting. I mean, the anticipation for this one for me is certainly as strong as any of the ones that I've,
yeah,
seen in the
Stronger
theaters.
Stronger than for Casino Royale?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
Because that sort of raised the expectations.
Yeah. Not only the idea that, hey, they actually can make a good James Bond movie. I mean, that's, you know, as a fan, you sort of believe in the inherent coolness of the character or the material. You know, what's great about Bond is that there's this tremendous flexibility that you don't get with a lot of pop culture sort of heroic figures. Maybe you get it with a Batman, or where you can imagine like ultra camp on the one hand and also very, very,
right,
dark and,
right,
hardcore on the other.
And a lot of these, I think no other character really has the chance to sort of explore all those avenues. I mean, there's, what is it, 22 Bond movies,
right,
now?
Right.
And I don't think there's 22 movies, or at least, you know, Hollywood or English language movies about almost any other character.
Right.
So you get,
right,
that range.
I mean, maybe you get, you know, maybe they're back in the day, you know, Tarzan or,
sure,
Sherlock Holmes,
sure,
serials,
sure,
or something. But,
right,
but certainly in the modern kind of era of movie going, there's nothing like the character's sort of reach. You know, there's this global thing where part of the fun is that he can kind of, you know, he knows no bounds. I mean, he can pop up anywhere in any situation.
Right. And he does in Quantum of Solace, he goes everywhere, it seems like. They're just constantly jumping from, where is it, Bolivia?
Yeah, to Austria and Haiti. And right. You know, it's one of the I wish the character would jump around a little less often. You know, in earlier films, he's a little more confined to one or two locations. And I think what you get is the richness of the location comes right. through a little bit more.
Right.
But I have to say, to the credit of Quantum of Solace, the director, Mark Forrester, clearly was trying to get the production out of, you know, just shooting it on a set, in a studio, at sure. Pinewood or
right.
wherever.
Right.
And so a lot more of the local color, you know, of these locations, and they are very cool locations.
Oh yeah,
comes through, mm-hmm. and I think that adds to the, you know, to the film's distinctiveness. I mean, you know, the film it's not stylish in the sense of kind of one-liners coming every other, you know, second.
I don't know if there were any one-liners.
They're very, very few, and they're all very grim and very dark and. You know, which I was fine with, but the stylishness, I mean, I think Bond needs to have some kind of style, however
right.
defined.
Right, right, right.
And so I think Forrester does do a great job of, there's a lot of visual style, you know.
Right.
Some of it may be borderline a little bit too arty, but as a nice change of pace, I thought was great. The locations look great, the costumes, the production design. I think Dennis Glassner was the production designer. Looks fantastic. You know, one of the things that I think has aged very well, the two things that I think have aged very well in the 60s Bonds are the music. I think John Barry's music still sounds fantastic today. And those, you know, Ken Adams sets, you know, I mean, they're crazy and larger than life and just, you know, big villains' lairs and volcanoes and, you know, whatnot, but they still look cool. I mean, they're still that kind of like they have that sort of timeless 60s
right,
sort of
right.
Flavor to them. And I think that this film kind of taps into that very, very nicely. So it has a really cool sense of style to
right.
it.
And it seems almost a little like understated, though, the style. I mean, there's no villains' lairs in volcanoes or things like
true,
that.
True, true. But
I mean, it's not flashy style. It's just like a sort of effortless style that
true.
Bond has. There's that one sequence where they go, and I think they're in Bolivia at the time, and they're supposed to go to some sort of flea bag hotel that Bond's associate wants to book them at.
Right.
And of course, he says, "No way, are we going to stay here?" And they go to the super fancy hotel. And I think it's just like, that's the natural environment for him. And
right.
I liked how
right.
they sort of acknowledge that. And that is one of the only one-liners where she says that their cover has to be that they're teachers
right.
on sabbatical or something.
Right.
And he says, "Oh, and we just won the lottery."
We just won the lottery.
Yes.
Right, right. But, you know, I mean, there's a big hotel at the end of the movie.
Oh, right, that they blow up.
Where they destroy,
right.
which is this very, you know, ultra-modern, very sleek, but not over the top.
Right, right.
I mean,
and
not,
in the middle of
garish.
Nowhere,
yeah,
in
yeah,
the desert.
Right in the desert. And it feels very, you know, Bondian. It feels
it,
like,
yeah,
okay,
no,
this
that's
is,
true. You're
this
right,
is
yeah.
where this kind of character would, you know. And it's the right balance. I mean, the influence of the Bourne movies, you know, which a lot of writers have talked about in their reviews of this one, is apparent obviously in the action scenes. I mean,
right.
The action scenes are very has a lot of that very, you know, hyper fast cutting and editing.
Right, and the shaky cam
right.
and things like that. Yeah.
But I don't watch this movie and feel like it's a Bourne sort of copycat. It still feels very much in the Bond milieu.
Right.
You know, which is a little bit larger than life, a little bit more, you know, glamorous and stylish, and, you know, you're supposed to sort of, you know, the Bourne locations are all feel kind of, and this is cool, I love the Bourne movies, they're all sort of desaturated and kind of gloomy. And,
right, right.
You know, here they have some pop and some color and some vibrancy.
Right, right.
I think that works well.
I think maybe another thing, though, that there might be a bit of a thematic influence from Bourne in that the Bourne movies seem to be a lot about sort of Bourne is searching for information or his identity or things about his past. And ultimately, the more he finds out, sort of the more disappointing it is. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie had, like we were talking about before, that sort of gloomy quality to it in the story where Bond is looking for something. I mean, in this case, it's not so much answers as it is a sort of revenge.
Right.
And it ultimately turns out to be hollow or mm-hmm. not what he hoped for. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe, I mean, not having seen a lot of Bond movies, I can't say for sure, but that seems to me like a sort of maybe a downbeat note that you wouldn't have had in an older Bond movie.
Well, that's true. That's true. And maybe that is the influence of Bourne. Maybe that's just a reflection of the times we live in where we – I mean, look at The Dark Knight made, you know, scads
sure,
of money.
Sure.
And although, I mean, Iron Man was a pretty unconflicted
yes.
hero, and that also yes. made scads of money. But,
right.
you know, perhaps we're more open to sort of ambivalent heroes or dark heroes or,
right.
you know, the idea of Roger Moore kind of gaily sort of, you know, tripping through a movie with his eyebrow raised.
Yeah.
You know, that will probably, if they keep making Bond movies in 10 or 15 years,
that'll
inevitably that
yeah.
sort of lightheartedness
sure.
will return.
Sure.
But it's nice to get a taste of, you know, something a little bit more textured,
right,
a bit darker.
Right.
You know, my principal complaint with the movie is just that I think storytelling-wise, it feels very rushed. It's a very fast movie. I think it's the fastest in the shortest in the history of the franchise, and it flies by. In a lot of ways, that's an asset. You know,
right. Yeah, I liked that about it. I felt like Casino Royale had taken so many detours that it sort of got lost at certain points. And this, even though maybe you kind of don't have a chance to sort of grab on to the plot as mm-hmm. as much as you might like. I think by the end, I was satisfied with what had happened, you know, with the confrontation with the villain and with the sort of level of closure that Bond had gotten on mm-hmm. the Vesper situation from Casino Royale. And I never felt at any point like, oh, when is this going to be over, you know? And I think that's a problem with a lot of modern action movies, you know, Bond or not, mm-hmm. that these movies feel like in order to be important or significant, they have to be 2.5 hours long.
Right.
And that's almost always not the case.
Right.
And so I liked that this movie seemed to like, no, like, here's what we're trying to do. We're going to get in. We're going to do it. And then once we're done, the movie's over.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I think, you know, an extra 5 minutes or so sprinkled. And for me, it's not so much needing a lot of extra exposition or additional scenes. It's more moments where you just get to appreciate the setup of a character or a situation. There's a situation, I don't want to blow everything that happens, where someone, one of his colleagues, you know, comes to a tragic end. And the setup of it is rushed to the extent that when I watched it, half of me was sort of feeling like, oh, I'm supposed to respond emotionally
right, but
to what's going on, which
sure.
is fine and good for them to try and, like, you know, sort of take that seriously. But the setup is confusing enough where the other half of my mind is sort of, wait, what's going on? And how did we get to this point? And I'm trying to retrace the last couple of moments in the movie to get there. And so that robs me, and I'm assuming probably maybe other viewers might have a reaction like
right,
this,
right.
of the full impact of, like, oh, wow, that's really, you know, wow, that's a really powerful moment. And
right.
so I think there are moments like that where the film, you know, is at such a rush to kind of race through that it sort of blows right by kind of cool moments and ideas that are sort of floating around there, that if they just slow down a little bit to kind of take them in, I think the movie would have more impact. You know, as I say in the review, my favorite scene in the movie was the scene at the opera house.
Right, right.
Where I felt like the pace of that was a little bit more relaxed, and there's a great moment where sort of Bond and the villains, they come face to face, and that's one of the sort of great tropes in the series, the moment where, you know, the villain and the hero, they size each other up,
right,
and the hero
right.
and the villain says, you know, kind of has the look in his eye that, oh, you're the guy who's been messing with my plans, who I now have to try and kill.
Yeah.
And Bond usually knows who the villain is
well,
when
yeah.
he, you know, by the time he meets him, but still there's that okay, you're the guy who I'm, you know, about to try and take down here. And so that's sort of a standard moment. But here there's just a bit of a pause where they're just kind of staring at each other. And I thought that was very nicely handled.
Yeah.
You know, in an example of, you know, if you slow it down just for a moment. I mean, it lasts for, you know, it's a moment that lasts for, you know, 5 or 10 seconds. I mean,
sure.
It's extremely brief. But I felt like, now I can really appreciate, I can sort of savor, you know, this moment before we're sort of hurled into the next, you know, to the next chase or the next action.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose a few extra moments like that would have been helpful. And I do agree with you that certain colleague character who is, you know, dispatched, is someone that when they first appeared, I thought, oh, this is an important character and we're going to get to know this person. And I honestly thought during that scene when we see the person is gone, mm-hmm. that like, oh, well, that can't be right. They're going to come back.
Even though it's
extremely obvious that that's not the case.
Right, right.
So I suppose a few other moments. But again, I was okay with sacrificing those moments in order to get a movie that felt to me really, really like crisp with no fat on it.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike with Casino Royale, where again, not having seen a whole lot of James Bond movies, mm-hmm. and coming at it from just sort of knowing the pop culture references, and I've seen more, you know, Austin Powers movies and Saturday Night Live sketches,
right.
and Simpsons parodies or whatever than actual movies, I had this impression of James Bond as being all about the quips and mm-hmm. the gadgets and all that. And so much of that is not in Casino Royale. I think I was sort of taken aback and disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing coming into this movie that it was just going to be like a full-on action movie,
right.
I think I appreciated it more because that was what it was, and it did a good job at mm-hmm. that. And, you know, it could have been a – I mean, obviously there are certain James Bondian things that are going on here, but it could, with only a small number of changes, I think, have been a non-James Bond
right.
action movie,
right.
which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing.
No, I think that's great. I mean, I'm happy to see them sort of dispense with, bits of the formula that have kind of just calcified to the point where
right.
they serve no purpose. I mean, I always have the notion with the Bond movies that it's the formula should serve the story rather than what usually happens is the story serves the formula, where they feel like, well, we have to have this
lines and,
bit yeah. just because it's, you know, in the contract or
sure.
it's somewhere. It has to be done. And
right.
and at some point, you know, hearing him say, you know, order the drink or shaken, not stirred or something, you know, it's like, okay, enough,
yeah,
enough.
Yeah. And it'll come back.
It probably will. And, I mean, in Casino Royale, you know, he says his name at the very end of the movie, which was just a brilliant bit of, like, when we hear it, it actually, like, it means something.
Yeah.
It resonates. It's
right.
like, oh, wow, that's it's cool again, you know. Or he orders the drink at one point, and the guy asks him if he wants it shaken or stirred, and he says he doesn't give a damn.
Right.
And so little touches like that, you know, to sort of kind of play with the formula or sort of subvert it a little bit are fun.
Yeah.
And this movie just dispenses wholesale with a lot of that stuff. And I think to its credit, you know, one of the things that the movie has going for it is the action, though a little bit too choppy for me, although I think the Bourne style is, I don't have any real philosophical, you know, problem
yeah,
with that
yeah.
when it's done really well.
Sure, sure.
This is done well, but not quite as well. But we do get, like, we finally get to see, like, an Aston Martin, like, in a real car chase, you know? I mean, they've had this car in the movies for, like, decades, but it's always just to set up, like, a cool gadget or
yeah.
something sort of spectacular, and we never get the feeling of the car, like, at frighteningly fast speeds. We never get a sense of just real, like, on the verge of the car being completely out of control. And so
right.
this was a nice bit of we finally get to see, you know, this sort of iconic,
right.
You know, device of his really put through its paces.
Yeah.
So, you know, the movie has a lot of moments like that where you really feel like it's has its foot on the gas. And,
yes.
and you know, when it's on, it's really rather exciting.
Yeah, I found it quite exciting, and I would definitely recommend this movie. I think I'd probably give it about 3.5 stars out of 5.
Yeah.
And I know that was your rating in the paper as well.
Yeah.
So, so check that out. And I want to talk a little bit now, because in addition to Quantum of Solace, if you pick up Las Vegas Weekly this week or check it out online, there's a very extensive, involved history and criticism of the entire Bond franchise by Mr. T.R. Witcher. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Like I said, I'm not a Bond aficionado, especially. You and I actually over the weekend watched a couple of older Bond movies from Russia With Love and Thunderball, which I did enjoy, which are two Sean Connery Bond movies. So, but I want to talk about a little about your sort of top picks for the best Bond movies, and maybe a slightly unconventional one to put at the top, which is On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the one movie with George Lazenby as James Bond. So what is it about that that makes it the best?
Well, that's, you know, Lazenby has, I mean, he's gotten, I think, an unfair rap over the years. I mean, if you watch the movie, you know, as I say in the piece, he's no Sean Connery, but then, like, no one else has been Sean Connery either, and... You know, for a guy who was a model and I think a used car salesman at one point, you know, to take on, you know, maybe the most famous role in movies at that point, certainly one of the most famous, was, you know, pretty courageous. And I think he handled himself well. The reason the movie, I put the movie at the top of the list is that it's just very, very strong in all facets of its, you know, sort of craft. I mean, the story is the best story in the series. The locations are great. The action is great. You know, the 60s Bonds, the action, we sort of take with a little bit of a grain of salt now because, you know, action has moved so far beyond, you know, what you would see in some of the early films. But that movie, I think, actually still holds up pretty well, and for being 40 years old, that's, you know, that's a testament to its skill. And so, you know, all the kind of Bond elements of, you know, he's up at this, you know, he has to go undercover to Blofeld's lair up in the mountains. They found this fantastic location, this real live location at the top of the Swiss Alps, which just looks amazing. You know, there are all these beautiful allergy patients that he seduces. I mean, so you sort of get the full... You know, you get the full Bond kind experience. Done, you know, exquisitely well. But you also buy into it as a real story. Yeah. You know, I mean, as much as you can in these movies where, you know, he falls in love with Diana Rigg, who's you know, is fantastic actor and plays, gives a great performance. And, you know, things come to a poor end. And you sort of feel at the end like, oh, wow, that really is kind of kind of a downer. I mean, you've sort of, at some level, you've kind of bought into it as, you know, maybe not real people, but certainly more real than anything we've had, you know, in the series up to that point. So, but, you know, lists are funny. I mean, you know, I've got On Her Majesty's Secret Service as my favorite, From Russia With Love and Goldfinger very close behind.
Right.
And for those who would say From Russia With Love or Goldfinger, are either of those is the best Bond movie, I wouldn't, you know, I don't begrudge them that. Those are fantastic movies too. You know, it's people who tend to favor the Roger Moore movies a little bit more highly, or the Brosnan movies a little bit more highly than I do. That's, you know, there's a more fundamental
difference. Which is the more sort of campy, you know, silly version of Bond.
Well, you know, the Moore movies, are very, don't take themselves too seriously. They're very light and, you know, over the top and silly and kind of ridiculous. And when they work, you know, The Spy Who Loved Me is probably the best of those movies. That's fun. I mean, it's a good movie. No complaints about it. The Brosnan movies were sort of trying to be both. You know, they were trying to be sort of like hardcore, like the Connery movies. They were sort of trying to be light and, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but like the Moore movies. And so, you know, Pierce Brosnan looks great as James Bond, but those movies always suffered from this feeling of sort of schizophrenia, where at one moment it was like Bond is sort of playing like a serious scene, and Pierce Brosnan was always saying, give me scenes to play, and he wanted to sort of do what Craig is doing now, you know, give me scenes to play, let me be an actor here, I want to kind of take this more seriously. And so those scenes would sort of crowd up against, you know, Denise Richards popping up in Hot Pants.
Christmas Jones.
or, you know, in Die Another Day, this sort of crazy ice palace up in Iceland and just sort of stuff that was clearly in the, you know, you're not meant to take any of this remotely seriously.
Right.
And it's almost like bringing those two together is
doesn't work
as well as it could.
Right.
So it's almost like I think the Brosnans might have been better served going one way or the other.
Right.
You know, either look, if you want us to take it seriously, really try and give us a reason to do so. Or if you don't, just go full bore in, you know, this is completely over the top and, you know, let the chips fall where they may.
Right.
But, you know, Craig, I mean, what's funny is that Craig is doing some of the things that Timothy Dalton tried to do in the 80s, you know, to sort of bring the character a little bit more back to his roots. In Fleming's novels, and the reaction to the Dalton movies wasn't all that enthusiastic, although Living Daylights made its money. License to Kill didn't do all that well. But I think what Craig brings over Dalton, who I like his movies, is just an extra degree of kind of magnetism and intensity.
Right. He's very intense.
And you feel like like Sean Connery. When Sean Connery walked onto the screen in one of those early Bonds, I mean, you felt like, okay, he's the man.
Yeah.
You know, and when Craig walks onto the screen, you have that same kind of, you know, very visceral, this guy is very, very intense. And in this movie, it's, you know, it's breakneck, literally.
Yes. Yes.
In the punishment he dishes out and the pace of the movie. And that works wonders in this movie and bodes well for the next couple of them.
You know,
I mean, what's great about the Bond movies is, I mean, 22 movies in, you know, you can still imagine that the next one, they could make a really good Bond movie.
Right.
Maybe they will, maybe they won't, but I can't imagine any other franchise where
after that
22 movies down the line, you know, with a lot of stinkers, admittedly. If they were all great movies, we probably would have run out of – they would have probably run out of things to, you know, ideas by now.
Right.
But I can't imagine any other – you know, I went to see Indiana Jones. That's fourth movie in the series, and already that felt kind of played out.
Or I know you're a big Star Wars fan, and – that has kind of really fallen apart over time.
Yeah. You know, or I mean anything. I mean even with the Batman movies, The Dark Knight, you know, which I really enjoyed. But even that feels like they can't keep that
going for another
20 years or however long it is. So there's just
something. Or they'll have to put it on the shelf for like 15 of those 20 years. And
or hire Joel Schumacher back to make a lot of really lousy movies again and then bring in the next generation's auteur.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to bring Batman back to his roots. So it's a great time to be a Bond fan. I mean, Craig was great. And, you know, I think the franchise is in an interesting place right now.
Cool. All right. Well, let's talk briefly about some non-James Bond related stuff, because Bond really is like the only thing going on new at the movies this week. But I do want to actually throw in a quick plug for a couple of movies that came out last week, and the podcast was off last week. But Mike Leigh's Happy Go Lucky and Jonathan Demme's Rachel Getting Married, both of which opened here in Vegas last week, are both really good character studies, really interesting dramas, I think, with excellent leading performances from women, which is always something that's exciting to see. Two of my favorite movies of the year, I think, Sally Hawkins in Happy Go Lucky, which is a sort of, I think, unexpected kind of drama from Mike Leigh. It's about a woman who is extremely happy and upbeat and chipper and the kind of thing that sort of annoys you at first. But it really gets into, I think, the idea of how to be happy and what it takes to sort of have a positive outlook on life while everyone is sort of trying to bring you down, whether on purpose or not. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that about it, that I think it's less – a lot of even positive reviews of it have talked about how it's a good movie, but it's a sort of lesser work from him. But I think if you – it takes the subject matter seriously in a way that few people would, and I think that's one of his strengths. So – I like that movie a lot, and I like Rachel Getting Married a lot with Anne Hathaway as this sort of messed up drug addict who comes back to stay with her family for her sister's wedding. And it's got a lot of sort of family melodrama stuff that I think in someone else's hands could have turned into a Lifetime movie kind of thing. But Demi treats it all with a very light touch. And Hathaway, she's really good at playing those dramatic moments without overplaying them. And the way the movie is shot is sort of as if you just hung out with these people for the weekend. And a lot of it is really joyous and really happy. And the sad moments feel like they come sort of organically from that. So both of those, both still playing, that came out last week. I think people ought to check those out, you know, along with Bond.
Go see then, Bond.
Yes, go see Bond. Go see Bond. But, you know, if you've seen Bond or if Bond is sold out.
So they'll make another Bond movie.
Well, so. I don't think there's any question of whether they'll make another Bond movie. But check out those others as well. And coming up on DVD this coming Tuesday is another one of, I think, the probably the best movies of this year, or certainly one of the better movies this year, which was WALL-E, the Pixar animated movie about the robot who falls in love.
That was nice.
Which is a very sweet, old-fashioned sort of romance in a way, and almost like a silent film for its first half or so.
Which I think was the best half.
Yes. No, I agree. I definitely agree.
I think by the time the movie kind of goes up into space, still very entertaining, but a little bit more, okay, fine, you know, not that big of a deal. But,
right.
But the early parts of WALL-E kind of on this, you know, trashed-out planet Earth and no dialogue were very satisfying.
Yes.
I mean, it's, you know, it would be great to see some of that silent film stuff kind of return to movie making. I mean,
right.
I mean, I think of these big action movies,
yeah.
and I think a lot of that, this sort of pure cinema of just motion.
Right, right.
I think a lot of that could be even more effective with
less dialogue.
Let these images kind of, you know, that crews have spent millions and, I mean, you know, insane amounts of money to sort of pull off.
Right.
Just, I think the effect might be stronger with less dialogue. If we could just sort of watch.
Right. Just,
you know, just get sort of
lost
the images,
in the spectacle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit more. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a little bit unrelated to WALL-E, but I think WALL-E's at its best in those moments where it just allows us to kind of.
Right. You just
sink into the images.
Yeah, and it looks amazing. I mean, Pixar always makes movies that look amazing, but I think, you know, the design sense of this movie, I mean, it's not just like what kind of processing power did they have on their computer, but the creativity of the way the robots look and the way that planet
right.
looks, the sort of, you know, trashed out Earth that WALL-E has to patrol, and you really feel like you're in that world with him. And I think, you know, that's the great thing, is that you can get that emotional investment and the sort of experience of being within it, you know, and you don't need the dialogue. You
right.
don't need words or exposition or anything like that to understand who the characters are, to understand their situation and feel for them.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I think the movie is good as a whole, but it definitely does become a little more conventional, a little more jokey when they go up into space onto the ship where the humans are, who of
right.
course can speak.
Right. And they're all fat and unable to move because they've just been, you know, in this sedentary lifestyle in orbit, you know, just sort of shopping and eating and not getting any exercise, you know.
Right.
So we get our, you know, satire on
right.
modern consumerism and what have you.
It's a fairly mild satire, though, I think. I mean, a lot of – when the movie came out, there were certain, like, conservative groups, I think, who were up in arms about that idea, the sort of anti-consumerist slant or the environmentalism slant. And that's there, but I really don't think that's sort of the main point of this movie, and I think that has been overstated a little. I think it's just – it's a very entertaining film, and it's something that you can, you know, get lost in, again, emotionally. So.
Right, and take the kids to.
And absolutely, yeah, definitely rent that for kids. And there's a lot of cool stuff on that DVD as well, including a new Pixar short that takes
nice.
Place like on the margins of WALL-E. And quickly, another DVD that I'd recommend that's coming out on Tuesday that actually you and I talked about a few months ago on the podcast was Tropic Thunder with Ben Stiller and Jack Black, and an excellent performance from Robert Downey Jr. as the actor who decides to become a black person, basically, and really jumps into that role. And the characters in this movie, they're shooting an action or war movie, and they end up getting caught in sort of a real war with these gorillas in the jungle. And I thought this movie was very well done as a satire. It was funny, and it had some depth to it on the characters, and it only loses its way, I think, in the last maybe 20 minutes or so, where they're a little too concerned with action. And I think this is one of those movies where the opposite is true, where we wanted more dialogue, I think, and they spend
a little too much. More comedy and less things blowing up.
Things blow up well, but this is not really a movie about things blowing up.
Right.
And they kind of forget that, I think, towards the end. But rent both of those, I think, or buy them on DVD. Those are both some of the better movies from this year. And go see Bond.
Yes.
See Quantum of Solace.
It's good.
It is good. I agree. And that's from a non-Bond fan, I think it's entertaining. If you've never seen a Bond movie before, it's a good action movie to just check out. And it's very well made. And I'll plug again Rachel Getting Married and Happy Go Lucky, sort of smaller movies that are worth checking out. So a lot of good stuff at the movies, strange
Indeed.
Enough. I hate nothing this week.
Very rare.
So my thanks to T.R. Witcher for joining me this week.
Thank you, Josh. Always a pleasure.
And we'll be off for a couple weeks, returning after Thanksgiving. So tune in then. And for Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell.
Bell hates everything except me.